Okay. Actually, it was a good point in my speech to pause because I think we're at a bit of a transition here. Well, I can talk forever about lost opportunities, but this serves no purpose. Other than for others to learn from my experience, there are no more excuses, and now that I am privileged to be the leader of the Federation in Canada, I must learn Braille and learn it fully. Some of you may know I am reading the speech, and I told you already, with my typing speed. It's a bit of an acrobatic act, but it solved the problem of memorizing a half an hour speech. However, it isn't a permanent solution. My goal is to be able to read a speech in Braille. Braille came back into my life 2 years ago when I became pregnant with my son, Reese. I needed motivation, and Reese became that motivation. I wanted to be able to read to him, and not just by listening to a CD or by making up stories, though there's nothing wrong with that, but by really reading him a book. So I spent every day practicing and relearning the grade 2 contractions with my NFB Braille learning book. My goal was to read a print Braille book called Hurry Up, Franklin. While I reached this goal, I admit I read at a pace slower than the turtle in the story, but I read it.
Me too.
And I am practicing and gaining speed every day. I hope the meaning of the title of my speech, The Handicap of Vision, The Importance of Learning, The Skills of Blindness, is now clear. In the Federation, one of our philosophies is that blindness is not a handicap, but a characteristic, and that with training and opportunity, blind people can compete on terms of equality with our sighted peers. It is true that with the proper skills, such as Braille and good cane technique, and with opportunity, and with self-confidence and successful blind role models, and yes, with some practice, blindness is not a big deal. But without these things, being without sight, blindness can be difficult and can be a handicap. Being a person with low vision who has not learned the skills of blindness creates a handicap. It is a bit like sending a person out to fight a fire without teaching them the skills of firefighting. I appeal to all of you to think about what I am saying, to think about the handicap of vision, to think about how important it is to develop, to help blind people, no matter how old we are, no matter how much usable vision we have, give them the opportunity and encouragement to learn blindness skills, to learn the skills of our heritage. I am not against using vision. I use my vision all the time. I see some color if it is bright and contrasting, and I love playing with color to create my wardrobe and to decorate my house. My sight sometimes provides me with an additional tool for navigating in my environment. However, this sight serves as an additional tool, a supplement to my blindness skills. The blindness skills are the foundation, the visual tools an extra bonus or addition, and not the other way around, as is usually the case in conventional rehabilitation and teaching. It is interesting how even in the blindness field, we as blind people are divided. We are divided according to degree of vision, by numbers and terminologies that have little value, 20 over 200, tunnel and peripheral, legal blindness, and even the peculiar blind sport classification, B1, B2, and B3. If you don't know, B1s are totally blind, B2s are like me with a bit of vision, and B3s are people who meet the legal definition of blindness, but who still have a comparatively higher degree of sight. No wonder people are confused. No wonder people find it hard to identify themselves as blind. We try to reach a level on this ladder of sightedness, and we climb over each other in our race for the top. I say forget this ladder and forget the climb. Join me and all Federationists on the ground, the finest, most sensible, and most rewarding place to be. One of my reasons for being here and for being in the Federation is because of its positive and proud perspective on the abilities of blind people. I shudder when people ask me if I have any vision. When I answer yes, I can hear their sigh and their well-meaning comments about how glad they are that I have some sight, how lucky I am, how much easier my life must be because of that little tiny bit of vision. And what they don't say rings even louder in my ears. What they don't say, but what I know they are thinking, is how much harder they think my life would be if I was totally blind. How much more effort I would have to put into things. How totally blind people could not possibly function as well as I do because they don't have any sight. I cringe thinking about this common misinformation about the abilities of blind people. In closing, I thank the Federation for what it has given me and for what it will give people in the future. Thank you for letting the world know the truth, that Braille is literacy, that the white cane is a symbol of pride and equality, and that best of all, it is respectable to be blind. Thank you.
Some of you now can begin to understand the gift we have to offer. And we, all of us, some will want what we have and some won't. But it's our responsibility to find them and to offer them the gift. Our next speaker is one man's experience. This is Oriano Belusic, who was first president of the Canadian Federation of the Blind. One man's experience as a blind entrepreneur.
Say again. Very good. Thank you. It's Elizabeth asked me to talk a little bit about entrepreneurism. I don't know that I even know how to spell it properly. it's always a bit difficult to talk about oneself, but I'll give you a bit of a life story. And some of you have heard it before, or some of it before. I grew up in Croatia. Basically in a small village, 7 kilometers you know, close to any civilized little town type of thing. Grew up as a kid. There was no preschool, so just had to grow up with my friends in the village, you know, running around, organizing slingshot war games and that kind of thing. And entered grade one, normal school there in the village with other friends and buddies. And in March of 1970, out gathering some flowers with my friend, came across this metal device which was fully enclosed, and of course got into a scrap with my buddy as to who was going to get to open this thing, and I won that little fight and started banging away with a rock on the device, and the rest is history. So it went off, and so did my arm and my eyesight, and that's there was really no adjustment to blindness. I don't remember any adjustment to blindness. it was there, and my dad came down and picked me up. I was a few hundred yards away from our house in the forest, and I remember asking him to take something off my eyes. I thought it was just something covering it, but I don't think. I think he was in total, you know, shock, and got to the hospital. And a few weeks later, you know, managed to go home and change the gauzes, all that stuff. And my parents didn't have much education, so they relied a lot on others to, you know, give them suggestions as to what to do with me. I mean, here was a blind kid in a village, you know. What the expectations, and I may use the word expectations a few times, were very low. You know, you can't, you know, the tragedy was almost fully complete. What, you know, what more worse could happen to someone type of thing. So people didn't really expect, you know, much out of, you know, out of the blind kid, so on and so on. So basically they sent me off to a school for the blind in Zagreb that September. And that's, I think, you know, looking back on it, attending schools for the blind, you know, miles and miles away from home, probably made me more worldly and toughened me up a little bit. Initially, it was quite difficult to be away from the family that I was always with, but managed to adjust, you know, quite quickly and learn quite quickly. And, you know, as soon as I went back to the village, it became almost a game for me to beat and, you know, shatter people's expectations. You know, just being able to walk around the village, you know, with no vision, you know, right away started shaking people's expectations. And basically that's the game, I think, that I adopted for years to come. I thrived on, you know, shocking people, surprising them, beating expectations. I achieved quite well in school. You know, it was always fun when the teacher would point out that, you know, my score was the was the highest, and it worked out pretty good. Now, a little bit about my character, though. I was a bit of a oddball sometimes in attending the school for the blind in Vancouver. We immigrated to Canada in 1973, and right away I checked in the school for the blind in Vancouver. My parents put me over there at the suggestion of Isabel Beveridge here in town, and one of the little events I was involved in late in the evening, you know, kids would go and play in different parts of the school, and we went down, a couple of us or a few of us, to the classroom area where we weren't supposed to be that hour of the evening. And but I remember the teacher earlier that day showing us this full-size skeleton of a human being, you know, with a skull and bones, everything. So I got this thing out of the closet. and started rolling it down the long hallway. And not meaning anything too terrible, but much to my surprise, the supervisor came down looking, you know, trying to check up on us to see what we were doing. And you wouldn't believe the scream that came out of her when she saw this thing coming down the hallway. And of course, it was dark in that part of the hallway because no one was supposed to be there. It was off limits at that time of night. So it was quite an experience for her, although I think her scream shocked me more than probably herself. But it was kind of neat because, of course, the plastic bones were rattling as the thing was going on. So it was quite something. And then another little, we used to go hiking and camping every second weekend, with some supervisors when we were at Jericho. We were having a nice campfire, there was a tunnel there, abandoned railway or something, and nice campfire, everybody was just quiet and just listening to the fire thing, and I got my hands on these 22 blanks somewhere. So I decided to throw them in the fire, and the poor supervisor just went nuts when these things went off. So I had to miss the next camping trip. That was my little thing. Anyway, so these are the sort of little things, and there's probably others, but I won't go on about that. When Jericho closed down in the mid to late 70s, I was one of the first students to be integrated into the public school system. Worked out very well for me. I knew Braille even before coming to Canada, learned it in Croatia, and functioned reasonably well, managed to integrate quite nicely with quite a large number of students in school. And I always, traveled with a cane up until, was it grade 10, I believe it was, and misused it deliberately if I ever did. I would walk home from Esquimalt Senior Secondary, not with the cane in front of me, but with the cane on the road at the side of the curb just making noise. I could hear, the poles, and I would just go around them, because it was such a familiar route. And I don't know how many of you know Fred Poon, but he used to refer to me as one of his star pupils when it came to cane usage in Jericho. And, except I managed to even annoy him. Because one evening, somebody told me, to make more noise for the friend of mine that was following behind. So I started hitting my cane harder on the sidewalk, and he goes, "You're causing sparks with the tip." So that would be, as a kid, I was kind of excited. Probably, I was the only guy that walks around and causes sparks with the cane. So it was so much for the star pupil. Managed to graduate from Esquimalt Senior Secondary and went to take computer science and economics at the University of Victoria. Graduated with economics, BSc in economics there. And took a job with the provincial government for 6 months, during which time there was a special competition for entrepreneurs. And one of my contacts in the government suggested I apply, and I did, and out of about 600 people, 30 folks were chosen to go to a one-month retreat, Shawnigan Lake, and I went up there, spent 30 days with these other 29 or so entrepreneurs, and managed to meet a couple of colleagues there, and we set up a computer business in 1989, same year I met Doris, my wife, and got married. We bought a house for $100,000, probably the ugliest, run-down house you could imagine. It had a wooden toilet. I remember taking my friend Trevor to look at it. He goes, He was just shaking his head. I don't know what you did. And he was one of my business associates at that time. And just shaking his head, he said, that's an old dump. Our business downtown at that time was doing pretty good. You know, we computer sales in the early 90s and computer work was still quite a hot, you know, way to make money. You know, in 1991, between the three of us, we grossed $750,000 in business, and we were doing pretty good. You know, and basically, that was probably the high time, though. In the next few years, others learned about how well computers, you know, could do and a good way to make money. But of course, as more people get into it, the take for everybody gets less and less. So our business partnership folded up in 1993. And in 1994, again, the business was a bit slower and each of us went our own ways. So I decided to, you know, explore the idea of subdividing the property and make a bit of money that way. Initially, we were turned down, of course, and you know, another key word is persistence. In this sort of game, you just have to be persistent. Failing is just part of the thing. You know, you walk out of there and you gotta know. So it's not easy to take, but it's part of the game of entrepreneurship, I think. Try it again, though, you know, because by not doing anything, you don't get anything. So we tried again, and we were successful in the second try. So managed to build our duplex. I had a tremendous. It's probably one of the more rewarding things. In my life, I think organizing, you know, trades to actually build. You know, I can't say I put a single nail in myself. I just I work the phone, I organize people, and you know, you try to mediate little problems, big problems. Some of them can't communicate at all. They, you know, I think they're out of the A page or something. And others would talk all day and not do any work. So. You know, it was actually a fun thing. I really enjoyed it, and all the horror stories people were telling me about people contracting their own homes didn't apply at all. It, you know, I think you can always work things out with people if you can figure out that it's in their interest and your interest to make it work. You know, because they want to do the work, they want to get paid. You want them to do the work, and you know, you want to pay for it. So it's not that difficult of a formula. That was, you know, at the same time as we were working with the Federation and keeping busy. So I had lots of things keeping me busy, even though probably making a lot less money in my computer business than ever before. And one of the smarter things I was involved in was getting Elizabeth, our great president, elected in 2000 and what was it now, two Elizabeth or three? Yeah, 2003. So, having a bit less to do at that point, we decided to go out and purchase three more properties, and it just happened to be the timing. The timing was right. We, you know, bought it again. You know, people look at you kind of crazy things. You know, one of the things I did was bought a small narrow lot that nobody could ever do anything with, and. That turned out, you know, very well for us. Basically, turned a $15,000 piece of property into a, you know, nearly $300,000 house that sold a few months ago. And the other properties, even without doing anything to them, just because the market's gone in our favor, you know, have gone up probably 40% from the time we purchased them. So we're doing, you know, pretty well in that department. But really, the whole thing is, I think, expectations and a bit of a gamble. You have to be prepared to lose, you know, to fail. And this is, I think, the biggest problem a lot of people have is, you know, they're close to their friends and their associates, and nobody really wants to try some venture and fail. You know, it's just people, we're not programmed that way as humans, and we're, You know, everybody likes to hear about success. Nobody likes to go around, have beer, and talk about failures. And it's difficult, I think, for people to, especially when they're in their hometown and they're, you know, very familial surrounding, sometimes try something that they really want to do. So, you know, if that's one of your, you know, glitches or problems, I almost suggest sometimes it's better to go somewhere abroad, you know, or go to a different town and try your experiment or try what you want to do. And if it works, great. If it doesn't, well, you know, it's something that at least you have to try and test out. You know, a lot of immigrants come to this continent and, you know, they're desperate, destitute, they're having two, three jobs. But they don't have the same baggage, I don't think, that a lot of people who have lived here all their lives maybe have, you know, this fear of failure. So they try a few things, and next thing you know, they're driving around in a Mercedes, you know. It pays off, and they succeed. So I just challenge everyone to think of what it is that's preventing them from, you know, trying something or taking a bit of a gamble, because we're in a new kind of, you know, work environment, new kind of employment environment. There's, you know, hundreds of thousands of people unemployed amongst all the blind and other disabled, etc. These days, you have to explore different kind of ideas. You know, there's eBay, I think, creates some tremendous, you know, opportunities for people for selling, you know, if you've got some sort of invention or product. The internet can make, you know, basement operation look fancy and give you quite a marketing tool. A lot of companies these days, it just exists on the internet. You know, it's, and they do remarkably well. You know, there's a whole realm of things that I think blind people that I've met, many of them, are tremendous telephone information workers. You know, they can find any service in town, hunt almost anything down. And that's a skill that a lot of, you know, our sighted friends have troubles with. You know, it's difficult to, you know, start navigating, especially these days, gosh, to start navigating the, you know, federal, provincial, and municipal governments for services when they're all trying to hide them behind automated voicemails and everything else. You know, I've helped a few people apply for, you know, CPP or apply for disability benefits or different things. And it's much easier, I find, to advocate for someone else than it is for oneself. So, but that's a career that somebody could make. There's a lot of immigrants that have very poor language skills in this country. You know, they need someone to help them qualify for all the things they're, you know, rightfully entitled to. And that's, you know, there's opportunities, I believe, almost anywhere out there. If people choose to, you know, choose to pursue them. There's much else I can probably talk about, you know, trials and errors and failures and so on, but I'll finish here and open up any questions you think we'll live with, or?
I think we'll wait
until later?
Lunch,
okay.
Just
all right.
Because we,
yep. Yeah.
I think we have one more big
sure. Mm-hmm.
Break.
All right.
And then we're going to have one.
Well, thank you very much, and I look forward to talking to you later.
Collect more vendors and exhibitors of aids and appliances for the blind, computerized materials and equipment than any other single gathering anywhere in the world. And our national convention is going to be in Dallas, Texas this next July. I should know the dates. The 2nd through the 9th, I believe, are the dates. And the hotel, for those of you who may have gone to a national convention in Dallas before, it is not that hotel. It is not the Airport Hyatt, because that hotel only exists partially. They took out one of the towers for a runway, so it's not big enough. Yeah, it's not big enough for us anymore. This is the Anatole, which is a very, very nice resort hotel right in downtown. So if you were thinking you didn't want to go to Dallas because of the arrangements we've had in the past, the hotel was at the literally at the airport and 45 minutes away from everything else in the world. That's not going to be the case this year. You'll be right in downtown, absolutely beautiful hotel and accommodations, and hope that all of you will be able to make it because I think it's going to be a great convention. I also think it'll be a little easier to get to by air from Canada than Louisville. I know most of you had to take three different aircraft. I did from where I live in Oregon to get to Louisville, so I will be happy about that. The year after that, we will be in Atlanta again. So if you enjoyed Atlanta, it's coming up for a repeat performance, and that will also be at the Marriott as we have had in the past when we've been in Atlanta. Let me see, what other things do we want to talk about? Oh, publications. If you would like to receive any of the many, many publications that the National Federation of the Blind produces about blindness, we have our monthly magazine, The Braille Monitor, and you can contact the National Center for the Blind and request that the Braille Monitor be sent to you in Braille, cassette, disc, print, whatever medium you would prefer. And you can also download it from our website or read it on the website. It has articles about everything you can imagine going on with blind people in the United States and also in the world, because we do keep up on the World Blind Union events. And if anybody in here wants to submit an article about things that you're doing here with the Canadian Federation, I am sure that we would be happy to see that in our national publication. There is The Voice of the Diabetic. There is a magazine distributed for parents of blind children called Future Reflections that is an absolutely wonderful magazine. And then, of course, all of the different divisions and organizations within the NFB have their own, the Student Slate. There's a magazine for blind educators and lawyers, and all of those professional divisions put out some of their own publications. And also the Colonel Books. And are you all familiar with the Colonel Books?
Yes.
The Colonel Books are ways that the National Federation of the Blind has made an effort to really gain a public awareness about what blindness really is, not about what most people think it is. So each of the Colonel Books is a collection of articles written by blind people about everyday things that blind people come across in their daily lives. And it is meant to provoke some thought inside of people, but mostly to make them realize that, you know what, by and large, our lives are just like theirs. We just do things a little bit differently. There is a contest every year. If you write an article that is that you submit to be in one of the Colonel Books, your name goes into a drawing for $1,000. And it doesn't, you don't even have to actually get published in one of the books, but you do need to submit an article. So think about some of the things that you deal with in your daily life. There were many things that Elizabeth had in her little talk that could easily have been put into a Colonel Book article that would have been really nice for a sighted person to read and kind of get a, oh my gosh, I never even considered how much more useful Braille would have been for this child growing up than what they put her through. Also for parents of blind children, I think some of that information would be really fine to have. So it is available. It is mostly free or at a very, very low cost to you. Now, I don't know, Paul, when it comes to Canada, are there shipping costs involved, or does that still go free matter?
No, it can go free matter.
Okay.
Large print doesn't, but Braille and cassette.
But Braille and cassette do. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So, you know, it's good not only for you to distribute and get out to other people as a teaching tool, but also a lot of the articles that we have and a lot of the publications are good for you, just to, you know, get that uplift of there's other blind people out there doing good things and kind of inspirational for what you need or want to do with your life. Okay? All right. So that's my brief update, because I know we have many exciting things to get to on the agenda, and I don't want to take anybody else's time. So there you are.
When I was asked to say a few words from my perspective as a sighted Federationist, I was honored to be asked. But I was reluctant to accept because I couldn't think of anything to say.
We need to give you a beer.
Yeah, good idea. Good idea, Paul. Yeah, good idea. Coming right up. The reason I couldn't think of anything to say is because I don't believe that my perspective as a sighted person is any different from the perspective of a blind person. So many long-standing attitudes and structures are based on the misconception that the blind and the sighted are somehow fundamentally different. Well, the news is, we're not. There are two basic approaches to the question. One is the traditional agency or charity model, whereby the majority sighted establishment views the blind as less than equal to them, and as wards or recipients of their benevolence. The other approach is that of the organized blind movement, the National Federation of the Blind and the Canadian Federation of the Blind. That is an approach based on equality between the blind and the sighted, based on the blind speaking for themselves and not being spoken for by do-gooders who presume to know better and pronounce on their behalf. Based on the empowerment of the blind as citizens and equals, competent and fit to take charge of their own destiny and affairs. In comparing various countries in terms of their progressiveness or regressiveness in this regard, Dr. Jacobus ten Broeck, a renowned constitutional scholar, professor, founder of the National Federation of the Blind, and a former Canadian, said, I quote, "In Canada, the story is perhaps the saddest and sorriest of all. In that northern clime, an agency colossus bestrides the world of the blind from coast to coast, making free use of company union tactics wherever any independent sentiment dares to express itself among the disorganized blind. Only a handful of undaunted spirits remain to hold the banner aloft in the deserted battlefield." The charity mindset has long had a stranglehold on blindness in the Canadian consciousness. I recall an occasion when a blind friend of mine and I were walking down a Victoria Street, and a drunk beggar asked my friend for money. When the beggar realized that my friend was blind, he said, "Oh, I give to the CNIB. The man was so drunk he couldn't have remembered his own name. Yet he was unable to tolerate the idea that he, a sighted homeless person, would ask a successful and respectable blind person for money. He felt an instant need to try and reverse the relationship. That is the extent of the stranglehold that the agency colossus and its charity model have on the public consciousness. Dr. ten Broeck succinctly states the central flaw of the charity model. I quote, "There are large and powerful agencies which remain hostile to our movement. The worst of these seeks to impose upon the blind not less but more authority and custody than ever before. Under the guise of professionalism, it would perpetuate colonialism. Its philosophy is a throwback to the age of the silent client before the revolution in welfare and civil rights, which converted the client into an active and vocal partner in the programming and dispensing of services. In its lofty disregard of the organized blind as the voice of those to be served, it betrays its bureaucratic bias, that is, its distorted image of the blind client not as a person to be served, but as a defective mechanism to be serviced." Now, given a certain degree of progress that has been made in parallel struggles for economic and social equality and opportunity, like the civil rights movement, feminism, and diversity generally, one might have expected this backward attitude toward the blind to have died a natural death and been replaced by one based on equality, respect, and self-determination. But this has not happened in Canada. The cause of its delay can be stated in one word: fundraising. A massive charity establishment owes its very existence, its fundraising, to the public's continued misconception that the blind are charity cases. These moneymakers on the backs of the blind are, in the words of Dr. Tenbrook, the obsolete custodians who seek to defend their vested interest by subsidizing the ghost of the helpless blind man. The charity or agency establishment has done much to improve its image, but not its substance. They use some of the right words, but there is a fundamental lack of democratic accountability in the charity model. Blind leaders are often appointed as image savers, as tokens, but there is no mechanism whatsoever for democratic input and control by the blind collectively. Indeed, I recall when a blind colleague of mine suggested in a meeting that an agency for the blind should be ultimately accountable to the blind, this was received as a heresy against the established order, in which financial donors and sighted people hold the reins. To illustrate my meaning, let me cite a resolution of the National Federation of the Blind of Ohio. I quote, "A sighted person was appointed as the temporary chair of the Bureau of Services for the Visually Impaired Advisory Committee because the chair was unable to contact the blind person she wanted to appoint. The obvious solution would have been to appoint one of the other blind members to serve temporarily. We condemn and deplore the appointment of a sighted committee member as chair when competent blind members participate actively on the committee and would be willing to serve. Members of the NFB believe passionately that blind people have been subjected for so long to imposed leadership and control by the sighted that making such an appointment is particularly egregious. The National Federation of the Blind of Ohio has always maintained that only those elected to represent the blind can speak for the blind. I would like to share with you now two statements by sighted people that demonstrate the shift in thinking which must occur. They are examples of people making progress toward a better understanding. The sound of minds opening. I quote from Walking Alone and Marching Together, A History of the Organized Blind Movement. Among the most striking and heartening examples of this new spirit of cooperation and understanding, as opposed to condescension and pity, is a prominent Lion administrative assistant to a congressman. In the past, the Lions, who have always felt a particular closeness to their blind neighbors, have done things for them rather than with them. The Lion says, "I believe we are on the threshold of a new era. I know that there are some of us in Lionism who feel that the blind are infringing on our right by conducting their own white cane drives, because for the last 25 years, the Lions have honored White Cane Day. But the white cane is a symbol of blindness, and what more understanding and true spirit of Lionism could there be than to return the symbol of blindness to the blind, and thank God they are able to carry their own banner? I believe that it is time we better understand our relationship with the blind, and to do that, we must better understand the blind. We should understand that you not only seek but are entitled to both social and economic equality, that you are normal people, and as such you have the right of self-expression as individuals and through your organizations, that both federal and state agencies should consult with your representatives in formulating programs that concern your welfare or further your opportunities. To this end, I believe we can work together as a team and lend a hand when it is needed. I believe that it is far better that we learn the purposes and objectives of your organization and help you to accomplish them, rather than try to steer you on a different course. In short, I believe we should work with you rather than for you." That was the sound of a sighted old man's mind opening. Now let's hear the sound of a sighted young woman's mind opening. I quote from a document entitled Enlightening the Sighted by Rebecca R. Long, a political science major at Gannon State University in Erie, Pennsylvania. "I was more than uncomfortable. It was my second day working as an intern for Leadership Erie, a leadership program for adults of the greater Erie community in Pennsylvania, and here I was at lunch sitting next to the only disabled person in the group. Her name was Judy Jobes, and she was blind. Disabled, That is how I thought of her at that lunch a little over a year ago. Now Judy is one of my closest friends and my greatest mentor in my career. She is anything but disabled. My understanding of blindness has grown because of Judy, but even more because of the National Federation of the Blind. My experience with the Federation began in January of this year. I came home from class one day to find a message from Judy asking if I'd like to attend a conference in Washington, D.C., during which we would talk to members of Congress about issues of concern to the National Federation of the Blind. I was hesitant, but decided not only to attend the conference, but to drive the six of us to D.C., since I would be the only member of the group with full sight. My friends and parents were baffled by this decision, dwelling on the burden they felt I was inflicting on myself. However, the opportunity to watch the political process in action shimmered before me, and I ignored the skepticism of my family and peers. Being a political science major, I couldn't pass up the chance to observe interest group politics. Before the trip, I envisioned learning primarily about advocacy. I wasn't thinking how much I could learn about blindness. Judy told me that the experience would change my life, but I didn't understand what she was talking about at the time. As I loaded luggage handed to me by my Federation companions, I began to get concerned. How was I going to guide all five of them at the same time? How much sight did each of them have, and how was it going to help? What if I did or said something that offended them? How much help was too much? How much were they depending on me? All of these questions pass through the mind of a sighted person when put in a situation dealing with a group of blind people for the first time. Finally, I decided I couldn't worry about it, and if I did make a mistake, there would be 500 blind people at the conference who could let me know. Saturday, there was a student seminar, and throughout the whole morning, I was disturbed. These blind students were upset with the injustices of the educational system. It was clear that they felt cheated of their right to be considered equal to sighted students. I sat in the audience and thought to myself, these students may be intelligent, but you cannot ignore the fact that they are blind and that blindness has to be considered disabling. I couldn't comprehend what it was these students wanted. By the time we sat down to lunch in the hotel restaurant, I was completely annoyed with myself for not being able to empathize with these students and the problems they were clearly having. But during the meal, I slowly began to understand. After being handed a Braille menu, I realized that the waiters had assumed that I must be blind. After all, their reasoning clearly went, why would a sighted person be interested in attending a conference for the blind? Deep in conversation at the time, I didn't acknowledge the waiter when he brought my entree. Presumably in an effort to be helpful, he pushed the plate I was eating from away and pulled the new one across to rest in front of me. This simple act was so terribly patronizing that I suddenly started to realize what these students wanted: to be treated with decency and respect for their abilities and for themselves. For the next 5 days, I was shoved into chairs, grabbed by the arm, stared at, pointed to, and referred to, usually in a hushed voice, as disabled. Those who realized I could see cast sympathetic glances at me as if I'd been trapped into community service or something worse. Even the assistants in congressional offices, many of whom had dealt with Federation members before, didn't realize how offensive it was when they looked at me as a leader simply because I could see. In those six short days, I began to see blindness as less a tragedy and more a simple, albeit bothersome, hindrance. I began to realize that Judy had asked me to attend, not because the Pennsylvania group needed sighted supervision, but because she knew that the experience would be invaluable to me. The philosophy of the Federation was evident once I allowed myself to see it. Given proper training and opportunity, blind people can compete on terms of real equality with their sighted peers. The Federation's ability to organize is amazing. Even the legislative offices in D.C. noticed it and commented on it. With this kind of organization and efficiency brought to bear on the problem, obtaining proper training for all blind persons is a potential reality. The Federation does more than provide training, advice, and support for its blind members. It enlightens sighted people simply by the example set by those members. The achievement of the Federation's goal of ensuring that proper skills and attitudes are taught to blind people will help to dispel the misconceptions about blindness that are held by the general public. The organization has already done this for me. That is the sound of a sighted young woman's mind opening. The Canadian Federation of the Blind, the organized blind movement, is working for the empowerment of blind Canadians, for equality, respect, opportunity, and self-determination. It will bring the sighted and the blind alike to a more realistic and positive understanding of blindness. An understanding that blindness is just a human characteristic, not a tragedy. That blind people are normal people who, with training and opportunity, can compete on terms of equality with the sighted. The sighted must come to understand that the blind are not their helpless wards or dependents, and come to embrace them as equals and fellow citizens, competent to take charge of their own destiny and participate fully in the economic and social life of this country. In the United States, where the organized blind movement broke the agency stranglehold decades ago, remarkable progress has been made toward these goals. It is time to break the charity stranglehold in Canada and to insist upon first-class, not second-class, citizenship for the blind. It is a privilege and a joy to participate in this work.
So, well, we're going to hear it from Carla McQuillan again. She's going to tell. I told you I'd get you back, Carla. She's going to talk.
We're working hard.
Yeah, we are. She's going to talk about discussion of blind preschool children. Carla McQuillan.
Thanks, Paul. But the nice thing about having a microphone is that now that I'm up here, I can diverge a little bit. I really enjoyed Rick's presentation, and it caused me to think of something that happened while I was at the Colorado Center that I want to talk about before I move on. I didn't hit nearly hard enough on the importance of philosophy discussions at the NFB training centers. It's a part of the curriculum on a regular basis, and what we try to do is pose questions of the students going through training about many, many things that have to do with blindness, but some of the big discussions are about the way that we are treated by the general public. And one of the philosophy discussions I was asked to lead was regarding the public's reaction and treatment of some of the students in the center. We all lived in apartments that were a bus ride and then a light rail ride away from the Colorado Center. It took about 50 minutes to get from the apartments into the center every morning. And a group of us rode the same bus every morning, along with a number of local commuters who also rode the bus into work. And one of the things that I began to notice day after day when I would get on the bus, and many of the students at the center were not like me. They were young. They were 18, 19, 20 years old. And they would step on the bus, and without a word, folks who were on the bus, seated, sighted people on their way to work, would grab a hold of the blind person and pull them down into a chair. Music! Maybe. You know what it is? It's the speaker that's feeding back.
Feeding back
from the music. Are we better?
Give it a second there. Okay.
Yeah. It's good. They would grab the hand of these blind kids and pull them down into the nearest empty seat. And I watched this happen day after day. And the blind kids didn't say anything, and there was not so much as a word from the folks on that bus. So I opened the discussion, brought this to their attention, and to my amazement, most of them, I think because they had been raised this way, didn't even notice it was happening. And one of my comments was, you know, in our society, it is unacceptable to touch another adult that you do not know without their permission. We just don't do it. In fact, we don't even do it to children anymore like we used to. And yet, a blind individual is not only expected to accept it, but to accept it quietly and sit down as they are directed and manipulated, I would say. Yes. They had canes in their hands, they would walk into the bus, and I mean, everybody knew that the apartments for the training center were there. They got on the bus every single day with canes in their hands, and some of them, depending on their attitude, in sleep shades, getting on the bus. That wasn't required until we got into the center, but yeah, everybody used canes all the time while they were at the center, even if they didn't want to. They learned to love it. But I think that, you know, some of what Rick said, we have for so long been raised in certain environments just to accept it because that's all we've known. And yet if we stop and take a real look at it, we're not being treated like our peers and our colleagues are. We are being treated as though we require someone else to help us. And I just would like for you to be not rude, not ugly, but aware when things like that happen so that you can hopefully do some education, put a little bit of a stop to it, because I think that it perpetuates because of the misconceptions, and I think that, you know, as Dr. Tenbrook said, our road to hell is paved with other people's good intentions, and I think we've been down that road long enough. So, all right. Now on to the subject at hand. I am the director of 3 Montessori schools. I have worked a little bit with blind children, but as I have worked a lot with the National Federation of the Blind, as I have done my teacher training program through Montessori, I have come to decide that what applies to sighted young children also applies to young blind children, and in some cases, we see it magnified, and I'll go through a few of the philosophies. I don't want to get into too much detail, but if any of you have specific questions or interest in learning more about working with young blind children, I would be more than happy to provide you with whatever information I have at my disposal, a lot of which is in my own head, because I find that there aren't people in this field who really have done extensive research on how we should be working with young blind children, which is one of the reasons that the Jernigan Institute has developed an early childhood committee and has decided that this should be one of the primary focuses of the Institute at this point in time, because it is an area of blindness that is virtually untrodden, and that we believe that if we can get in there with our ideas, then if the young children get the NFB philosophy when they're 3 and 4 and 5 years old, by the time they get to the professionals in the schools, they'll already be light years ahead of the expectations, and it'll be a lot harder for those professionals to tell the parents, no, they can't travel with a white cane, because they already will be. No, they can't learn Braille, because they already have. So this is where our priority lies right now with the organization. I find that very, very exciting. I'm going to do a little bit of talk about Montessori philosophy. For those of you who don't know anything about it, here's your crash course. Bring on the child. It was not about the teacher being the center of attention in a classroom. It was our role.
Excuse me, Carla.
Yes, sir.
May I change the tape? Dual price?
Yes, you may. What Maria Montessori said was, she was a medical doctor, by the way, one of the very first medical doctors. No, I believe one of the first female doctor in Italy. And she took more of a model that was not exclusively cognitive and social with 3, 4, and 5-year-old children. She took more of a big picture medical model. And one of the things that she said was that if we look at all living things in nature, we find several things to be consistent from one species to the next. Okay? Number one, the newborn of whatever species has a drive, an instinct to learn to be independent. Okay? That without anybody teaching them, right? The new calf learns to stand up and to run and to all of the different phases that will help that animal become independent. She believed that humans were the same. That the only thing standing in the way of proper development of a human are those well-meaning, caring, nurturing adults in their environment. That it is, in fact, the parents who have a tendency to stifle the natural development and progression of a child's independence. She called this instinct the conquest of independence, the child's conquest of independence, that from the minute they are born, they have a drive to learn to move and to crawl and eventually to sit up and to walk. And all of that is for the purpose of gaining more and more control and understanding of their environment, right? So what do as adults? We're concerned about safety, right? Do we do this with our children? So the child stands up and starts to run, and what do? Oh, slow down, you're going to hurt yourself, right? So we impose, it is in fact the adults that impose fear. The Montessori said you should never check a child's behaviors because it is only with running and stretching and lifting things that are too heavy. Well, every 2-year-old child wants to pick up stuff that's too big and heavy, right? Right? You should leave them alone. That's how they develop their muscles. That's how they develop their coordination, all of their skills. And all of that is instinctual. And we're the ones as the adults who try to stop it. Now, let's look at the blind kid. No. But your reaction is exactly correct. What do? We're worse. We are so afraid. So what do? Instead of letting requiring that blind child reach out, find something in their environment, and explore it, what do? We bring it to them. That's exactly what we do. So what are we teaching the child? Absolute dependence. We are teaching a child that if they wait long enough, we will bring stuff to them. I have found that the most capable blind adults who were blind as children are the ones whose parents absolutely did not know what to do with a blind kid. Right? So they didn't stop them. Bennett Prowse, I don't know if any of you know Bennett Prowse. Bennett Prowse is a blind lawyer, and he has a twin brother who is sighted. And what he said was that everything his brother did, his parents said, Ben, how come you're not doing that? They kicked him out of the house and made him go play outside. They made him ride a bicycle because that's what his brother was doing. And he believes that he is the capable, competent adult that he is today because he was expected to do everything that his sighted brother was expected to do. All right? The child's conquest of independence. So when the teachers and professionals tell you that your blind child will not walk, okay, and now I did not know. I'm so naive. I did not know how prevalent this was. I started working with a family with a 17-month-old blind daughter, nothing else going on, just blindness, no other disabilities. And of course, it's different if there are other extenuating circumstances. but a child who is blind with no other disabilities. And the mother told me they had this little girl in a playgroup, and that at 14 months, she was the only child in the playgroup who was walking, and she was the youngest in the playgroup, and there were children 2 and 2.5 years old. And I thought, well, what are you saying? Well, that the itinerants and the O&M instructors said that you can't expect a blind child to walk before they are 2 years old. Well, let's talk about a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you tell a parent your child won't walk until they're 2, what are you going to do? Are you going to hold out your fingers and let them walk with you? Are you going to stand across the room and call them to come to you? No, you're not going to do that. You are going to feed into what you have heard and ultimately prevent that child from their natural course of development. So what we in the Early Childhood Committee of the Jernigan Institute are trying to do, instead of creating the deficit model, which is what's out there about blindness, right? Although what would Mary Ellen say, the 20 lacks and what was it?
Lacks and
losses of blindness. We're not going there. What we're talking about is natural development of a child and what we need to do to make sure that our blind children fit into that model. It's the typically developing child model, and it should apply across the board, not exclusively to those perfect little children that some people wish to use as examples. It needs to apply to our kids as well. I run NFB Camp at National Convention Child Care for, usually 80 to 100 kids every year. And I have also done a babysitting workshop for CHOP Workshop Month. I'll move on now. A babysitting workshop for the teens. And a couple of years ago, I was working with, I think there were 12 teenagers, about half of them blind and half of them sighted. And the room that they gave me was so small, I could reach my hands out and almost, well, without moving my feet, if I leaned over to the left, I could touch this wall, and if I leaned over to the right, I could touch the other wall. And in the front, it was a little bit longer, but that's about how wide it was. We were not a big room. We're not talking big. We're talking half the size of this room, this little, where we're sitting now, not counting the tables, okay? Half the size of this room or smaller. And there was a pitcher of water in the front of the room, and there's a pitcher of water in the back of the room with glasses. Well, it was very warm. This was Louisville. You remember the air conditioning in Louisville, or lack thereof? Well, that was the room. So you got 13 breathing teenagers in this room, and when we went to take a break, very warm, I said, okay, you know, there's water up front, pound at the table. There's water in the back of the room, just the opposite in the corner. And I had several of the blind kids turn to their sighted friend and ask them to get water. And I said, oh, no. You're here in a babysitting workshop. If you think that you are going to take responsibility for someone else's children, then by golly, you ought to take responsibility for you. And a couple of them, braver than others, stood up first and went towards the water. We had a 15-year-old blind girl who has been with the NFB. Her family's been with the NFB for as long as I can remember. Goes to the back of the room, finds the water, starts pouring, and overpours her glass, and panics. Now, I'm looking at this and thinking to myself, where did we go wrong? She knew to put her finger over the lip of the glass. She knew, in theory, that she was supposed to stop pouring when the water touched the tip of her finger. But have any of you watched a 3-year-old try to pour liquid for the first couple of times?
No.
Okay, they spill it. And why do they spill it, Paul?
Well, because it's just not coordinated yet.
It's the hand-eye for the sighted kid coordination. It is the hand for the blind kid. And it doesn't matter. This is my new theory from observing this. This is, you're a scientist when you're a Montessori teacher, because that's what it's about. It's about looking at what's going on and figuring out what do we need to do to fix it, and what does this child need in the environment to make it better. That's my job. And I believe that it doesn't matter if she learns to pour water when she's 3 years old, she's going to overspill the glass. until she practices enough and becomes graceful, and it becomes natural enough that she stops immediately when that liquid gets to her finger, or when she becomes 15 years old, the process is the same. And what I think we do, and I've been told that in the NFB we're worse, because there is an expectation of perfection for our blind kids. There are these blind adults who are role models, who are, you know, as Paul and Mary Ellen and Elizabeth, very accomplished, very capable, graceful in their actions, you know, not appearing to ever have gone through the process, right? As they laugh, that's right, that's exactly right, and you know that. But I think sometimes the sighted parent of the blind children does not put that together. And so rather than to let their child be unsuccessful in their actions, they just do it for them. The child knows what the procedure is, but somebody's always there to do it, because the parent wants to see the success rather than the process. In Montessori, we talk about the process, not the product. What is important is the steps you take to get there. It's not that you're there. And if you don't go through the process, you're never going to have the product as you want it. And when children are young, when they are 2 and 3 and 4, 5 years old, the process is all that matters to them, because that's where they're developing and learning their skills. So my recommendation for people who have young blind children, well, for people who have any children of that age range, some of the things that are easy to incorporate, you know, set aside all the other expensive, extensive, complicated Montessori materials, what we call practical life. You set up activities where they learn to pour, and first you start with grains like beans. Then they learn, you know, they learn scooping and spooning and pouring of grains and then of liquids. You have activities like shoe polishing and all of the things, and I can give you a list. I even have write-ups that I give to my training classes. If you have children in this age range, I strongly recommend that in order to develop their skills in a non-judgmental environment and situation, if you put together these kinds of activities on a tray, you know, two pitchers pouring back and forth from one to the other, if they spill, guess what? They clean it up. That's part of the process. That's part of the process. That's the expectation. So if they spill, they're not going to panic, because they know what to do. Because isn't that part of life? You're going to spill, but you're not going to expect somebody else to do it for you, because you understand that's part of your responsibility. And if you start them when they're young, then they will have the grace, and they will have those skills, and they will think nothing of it when they get to be an adult. And they'll be able to interact just like everybody else in their environment. And so I encourage you to think a lot about this. I believe it doesn't matter whether a child is blind or sighted or whatever else. We train our children to do exactly what they do. One of my theories of development is patterns of behavior. I think that we encourage certain patterns of behavior, and if we stop to think about them, I think we wouldn't be very happy with most of the things that we encourage, but we do. And our children, once they get set in a pattern, it's a lot harder to change it than if they never got there at all. And one of the big patterns of behavior for blind kids is waiting for somebody else to do it for them. We had this little boy, Avery. When he was just barely two years old, he had a brain tumor that knocked out his vision, pressed on his optic nerve. Nothing else wrong with him, just suddenly lost his vision. And they came to visit the school when he was 2, and then when he was 3, he started. And when he was 2, he came in, his hands were all over everything in the classroom, just like you would expect a 2-year-old. Mm-hmm. A year goes by, he comes in, and he was not exploring, he was not curious, somebody had stopped it. Somebody was afraid he was going to hurt himself. So they stopped him from reaching out and exploring, and he became withdrawn. This little boy, every day for 2 years, my school, real basic. You come up the front stairs, there's a straight hallway. It's 6 feet wide, it's about 14 feet long. On one side is a wall, on the other side is carpeting that leads into the rest of the office, okay? kid with a cane cannot possibly mistake this hallway. Every day for 2 years, this child would walk in the front door and stop dead. You know why? Because he was waiting for somebody to take his hand and drag him along, because that's what he was used to. And I had a great assistant who was working with him who would stand, she loved to sing. So she would stand at the back door and sing to him. And eventually he figured out nobody was coming and grabbing his hand. And he finally would start moving. But he was with us 3 hours a day, and he was home the other 21. And, you know, the balance, or to try to counterbalance some of that stuff that was going on, was very, very difficult. And, you know, loving parents wanted the best for him, but were so busy trying to protect him from all of those safety hazards out in the world that they kept him from really developing a degree of competence and potential that he had. And those are a lot of the folks that we come across as adults who, you know, it's a challenge to turn that around. It's not that it can't be done, but the only way it can be done is if you have the positive attitude, the positive philosophy, and people like Elizabeth and like Mary Ellen and like Oriano and all the other people in this room to encourage you. We didn't all start where we are. I did not start where I am. It's been a process, and it's been a road for me. And it makes me not only pleased but honored for the opportunity to help other people along. So if you are feeling like you want that, you want to be like that, you want to have that level of confidence to walk out of here and go someplace you've never gone before all by yourself, you know what? There's a lot of people who started with that. I want that. I want to learn that, and I'm going to. And we can help you. That's what this organization is about. And that's why I'm here, and that's why I keep coming back to these things, is because when I walk out this door, I'm going to go through an airport where somebody, this is true, I'm walking through the airport. The airport is one of your favorite places, isn't it? I'm cruising along with my cane, and I was going through Denver, which I fly through constantly because that's the hub that I usually travel through every time I go to the East Coast. It goes a strip of carpet where all the gates are, then there's an area of tile where all the restaurants are, then it goes carpet, then tile, then carpet, then tile. Okay, so I'm walking along, and this gentleman walking next to me turns and says, "You're coming up on some tile." Now, I thought about this real quickly, and I thought, what information do you think he was trying to offer me? I mean, what did he want me to do about it, I guess, was my question, was yeah, and the cane is going to know that. You're going to hear that when I get to the tile. It's going to be different. But, you know, that kind of thing that goes on. Fred Schroeder tells a great story about, you know, he travels constantly. I don't know if you know Fred Schroeder, great guy. But he said that he was going to the restroom in the airplane. Now, you guys, you've been in these spacious, luxurious restrooms in the airplanes. Okay. And the flight attendant says, as he's going in, "Do you need some help, sir?" Now, he said, you know, I've often wanted to turn and say, "Why, yes," and figure out exactly what they were going to do. You know, there's not room for both of them in there, so. But, you know, they don't think. They don't think. I went to Walmart, and the woman tried to scan my cane and